This is a Faith Defenders audio podcast.
People have asked me to recommend or to give some comment concerning the commentaries on Romans. And since Romans is one of my favorite books, I have over the years collected an amazing amount of commentaries which I do consult and which do help me. Let me just preface then our study of Romans today by just simply looking through some of the commentaries, and I will weigh them in terms of their pros and their cons, and this will perhaps give you some aid if you wish to go out and purchase a commentary on Romans. Some of these, though, are quite old. I purchased some of them when I was in high school with my lunch money. So that they may be out of print at the moment would be a very rude reality, but nevertheless, these are considered the greatest commentaries on Romans in Christendom, either in terms of Reformed theology or even in terms of Arminianism. One little book that has come out not too late, and this was actually published in 69 and then has been updated, is Goffrey Wilson's little paperback on Romans. It is entitled A Reformed Digest. And what he does is go through many, many commentaries, and it's a simple little paperback. And if you ever want to study the book of Romans, as a layperson, I would say, get Goffrey Wilson. It's simple. He doesn't hobble you with a lot of Greek and Latin and Hebrew. Plus, he's quoting from other commentaries, and he tells you what commentaries he's using, so you would get citations from Hodge or Linsky or Haldane or Calvin or whatever. So for book studies, perhaps the best place to begin would be Romans, a digest of Reformed comment by Goffrey or Jeffrey Wilson, published by the Banner of Truth Trust. Then one that is helpful is Haldane, Robert Haldane on Romans. This is one of the books I purchased when I was a high school student. And this is the volume that caused revivals in Scotland, in France, in the Soviet Union, and in Switzerland. As the purity of the gospel was preached by the Haldane brothers, both have been raised Presbyterians, but they became Baptists. And the Haldane brothers, of being members of aristocracy, used their bloodlines in order to gain access to the great houses and families of Europe, where they then gave the gospel to kings and queens and dukes. And they were known particularly as being evangelistic, and by preaching on Romans, they saw they had more of an effect on their culture in their day. Of course, that does not necessarily translate over. And when you read Haldane, you will find many of his comments to be interesting, but he was not a scholar. He was not an exegete. And some portions of it, to tell you the truth, are quite boring. It's like reading a famous sermon by Spurgeon, and the introduction tells you that when he preached this message, revival broke out, thousands were saved, and you read it, and today it's quite boring, and you know the difference is the Holy Spirit. As the Haldanes preached this material, the Holy Spirit applied it to the heart. So this keeps us humble. We must always remember it's not the human agent that causes revival. The same sermon preached on two different places by the same man will have two different results, depending on the Spirit of God. Then you have William Hendrickson on Romans. And of the modern commentators, he simply is the best. I recommend every commentary by William Hendrickson. He deals with the text in a clear manner. He does not avoid exegetical problems. He puts them in footnotes, or perhaps he has an appendix. And overall, I find that his commentary on Romans to be one of the first ones I turn to. The same thing with Hodge's commentary. The famous Princeton theologian, I highly recommend Dr. Hodge. He was ill toward the end of his life, and he said the Lord had told him that he would not go home to be with him until he had finished Romans. And after he finished writing out the last pages of this commentary, not too many days hence, he went home to be with the Lord. Then John Murray from Westminster Seminary, one of my professors, what can I say? His commentary still, in terms of modern critical works, would be the most important. This would be, as far as I am concerned, if there's a disagreement among the commentaries on an issue, generally I find that Murray is right on the button. Then there's another one that I picked up when I was a high school student, and this is a critical and doctrinal commentary on the Epistle of St. Paul to the Romans by the famous Dr. Shedd. The only trouble is, as you will see, the text is totally in Greek with no translation. So just in case there's some pastors out there, this is one for you to chew on. He doesn't bother translating it. In those days, when he taught at Union Seminary, Theological Seminary, any theological student who didn't know Greek and Hebrew and Latin and French and German was a nincompoop and shouldn't be in the ministry anyway. Imagine how few pastors we would have today if they had to take texts where it was not translated. Martin Lloyd-Jones has preached through the book of Romans, and it's a multiple volume series. You will indeed find much material, some of it on Romans 6 I disagree with, on Romans 7 I disagree with, but overall, if you're going to preach, you may get a few ideas, but don't think it's going to be a classic on the subject. Then there is the famous Lutheran commentary on Romans, Olshausen, and it's interesting to look at his comments because he does use the Greek and the Hebrew, and it is critical, but you get the European Lutheran flavor from that. The same thing with Joseph Mayer's commentary on Romans, and this is part of the Mayer's commentary on the New Testament. This, again, is very technical, primarily dealing with the Greek and the Hebrew. It does not translate things. You do not read this for devotions. It would be of no use to read it for devotions. You read it when there's a text, for example, you're concerned about where Christ seems to be called in Romans 9. Is it that Christ is God who is blessed over all, or is it God should be blessed? He goes into that, and he is excellent when you come to these little picky points. Now, Godet on Romans, this was another one I purchased when I was a high school student. My edition was published in 1956, and it was a series entitled The Classic Commentary Library. And by my senior year, I had purchased nearly all of them due to the influence of a bookstore manager by the name of Johnson, who went on to work for Zondervan. So when I went to college, my first year, I had the Classic Commentary series. Now, Godet, basically, to tell you the truth, was a liberal. You have to watch Godet. Read what he has to say. It's interesting, but most of the time I put it down and I shake my head. He attempted to be Bible-believing and liberal at the same time. He was a French Huguenot scholar who wanted to be a moderate, like on issues of whether or not the Bible's infallible and things of that nature. He wanted to say, oh, yes, it is, when he was in certain circles, and oh, no, it isn't, when he was in other circles. He was really a man for all positions. The trouble is, then when he came to clear text, he often didn't give you what was there. Or worse, being committed to Arminianism, he took pot shots at Calvinism all along the way. The same thing can be said of Linsky, the Lutheran. And Linsky, I find to be an interesting commentary. I do use Linsky a lot, particularly when it comes to points of Greek grammar. He's excellent in that regard. But his defense of baptismal regeneration, infant salvation, the Lutheran doctrines, and his hatred of Calvinism, he couldn't help but put in the commentary. So you will be reading where he's expounding a text, and all of a sudden he takes off in a tirade against Calvinists, whom you can see from what he has written, he had some bitterness concerning. So it is marred by a bitter spirit which comes through with Linsky, though, as I said, he is valuable. Connie Barenhausen, The Life and Epistles of St. Paul. This book is invaluable because it gives you the historical background. It tells you the cities where he traveled. There are even notes with each epistle, such as Romans, so that if there is some archaeological confirmation that has been discovered for something mentioned in Romans, Connie Barenhausen will give it to you. Then you have the Episcopalian series. This is Ellicott's commentary on the whole Bible. And I find it to be uneven. This is another one that I purchased when I was a high school student. I was impressed with it when I was 16, but not by the time I was 20. I have been tempted at times to dump it, but then there are a few appendices that seem worth it, so I do keep it indeed on my shelves. The Epistle to Romans, the commentator is Dr. Sandy, the Reverend Sandy, who was a fine scholar. Even though Ellicott is the general editor, Sandy is the commentator on Romans, they skip over any hard verses. That is, when you need a commentary is when you have a verse that's difficult. Well, like Matthew Poole and Matthew Henry, if there's something difficult, they skip over it and go on. So I have been disappointed many, many times. I wouldn't exactly say rush out and buy this one, but it does give you the Anglican view of things. Calvin's commentary, I recommend that without hesitation. Another Lutheran, and this is another set I purchased as a high school student, and this is John Peter Lange, who is the editor, and it's the Lange commentary on the Holy Scriptures, critical, doctrinal, and homiletical. And Lange himself did the commentary on Romans, and then it was translated into English from the German by Dr. Hurst, who was a Presbyterian. And then you have little comments by the famous Philip Schaff, the great historian. And I do find, indeed, much worthy material in Lange. It's a huge set. I don't know if it's in print still. Imagine back when I was in high school in the middle 60s, the 12-set volume was retail $89.50, and that was back in the 60s. And I remember buying these at 50% off. These were a very large investment for me, but they have paid off, and I recommend Lange to anyone who can have the opportunity. Another one that's just on the Greek text, but I turn to it all the time, is the famous Expositor's Greek Testament by Nicole. I can truly say I have profited from this book again and again and again. I highly recommend it for pastors, those who know Greek. Again, it's the Greek text, no English text, and he doesn't translate it for you. But his comments are helpful in terms of critical an analysis of the text. Vincent Word Studies I find to be totally uneven. You will read 10 pages of Vincent and you might find one thing that's interesting or helpful. Usually, if the word or if the passage has any controversial issue involved, he skips over it and goes on. I guess he figures the less said, the easier his books would sell or something. Randy Yeager, my old friend Randy, who has gone to be with the Lord, published the Renaissance New Testament, and his commentary on Romans, by and large, is excellent. He was basically reformed in his outlook, but his comments are marred by his taking the liberal stance in the Southern Baptist denomination. He was one of those who denied the inerrancy of Scripture. And he and I had many discussions in which he would try to show that the Bible had errors and mistakes and contradictions. So you have to watch Yeager, because sometimes he sneaks in his comment just to hit the Bible believers over the head a little bit. A.T. Robertson, the great Southern Baptist, his Word Pictures in the New Testament. It is helpful for word studies, and as you read him on Romans, again, like Vincent Word Studies, you will read 10 pages and you might find one thing of merit. Dean Alford, not only a theologian, but a great hymn writer, a revivalist, a scholar by all means, wrote his excellent series, The Greek New Testament. This was published in 1958. This is another one that I got shortly after I went into college, and I have enjoyed this material for years, particularly in the early 70s. I think it was around 1969, 1970, I purchased this. Again, it's on the Greek text, but I find him to be very profitable. It's dated material, but there. Now, that you say, now, why'd you go through all of this? Well, there are pastors who listen to these tapes, and they don't know what commentary to get, and there are lay people who really want to dig into Romans. You'd say, well, then, Pastor Maury, Pastor Bob, what commentaries, if you only have so much money, would you tell people to get? Immediately get Hendrickson. Hendrickson on Romans, if you have that, and that's a hardback, and that's a large volume, that'll hold you in good stead. And if you don't want to spend for a hardback, then get Goffrey or Jeffrey Wilson, the little paperback, that's fine. But the others, they're interesting for those who want to dig into the Word, and I think these comments are helpful indeed. Now let's turn back to the book of Romans. We were in chapter 3. Yes, a question. Any Christian bookstore would be able to order them. They would look in books in print, or they could look in their libraries. The only ones I warn about would be Godet. I would warn about Linsky. And I would warn about Randy Yeager because of their views on inerrancy and their anti-Calvinistic flair, which has no business in a commentary. They're to give you the text and not grind their axes, which they do. But I would say if you get Wilson and you get Hendrickson, you have probably the best that there is. And if you want to get a little bit more scholarly, then you go for John Murray and some of the others I recommended. Any other questions? Yes.
Many times commentary is sold in entire sets, keep costs low and so forth. Would you recommend Hendrickson for the entire scriptures, or and I'd rather read from Romans right now? But is he good overall?
A question has to do with purchasing entire sets. Particularly William Hendrickson, yes, buy everything Hendrickson ever did. It's the best of the modern New Testament commentators. He's gone home to be with the Lord, and he never finished the entire New Testament. I feel terrible about that. He was a Christian Reformed scholar connected with the Grand Rapids Reformed Bible College. It was the only Bible college in the United States where you could go and get a sound Reformed perspective. I got involved with them in my second book back in 74, because they were leading the fight against Hermann Dooyeweerd and the philosophy of the cosmonomic idea, which simply means there was some Dutch heretics trying to take over the Christian school movement. And William Hendrickson appreciated my book, and I, as a young person, I was deeply, deeply humbled and happy and thrilled that the great Dr. Hendrickson, one, had even read my little book on Dooyeweerd, and then number two, expressed his desire to use it to fight against those who were denying inerrancy. So this was a solid Bible-based, he believed in the inerrancy of Scripture, he helped to establish the Bible College, and God has used that to pour Bible-believing Christians into the Christian Reformed Church.
So he was a Paedo Baptist?
Yes, he was a Paedo Baptist because he was Christian Reformed. But that does, he doesn't have any axes to grind. He was a nice old Dutch uncle. I met him. And sweetest guy, he's like Dr. Van Til, except Van Til in his writings you would think was a bitter, vicious old man. But when you met him, he was a pussycat. They called him Uncle Corny at seminary. A really a nice man, kind and gracious, same as Dr. Hendrickson.
What about Kistemaker?
Dr. Simon Kistemaker is a friend of mine. We worked together at the Evangelical Theological Society. He is, again, a Christian Reform, and I'm not aware of him ever doing anything on Romans, but he was called upon to finish up and to edit some of the material that Dr. Hendrickson had left behind. But yes, he's generally fine, a fine author.
Continuing that series of...
Yes. He's continuing it, and some of the material comes out of the manuscripts that Hendrickson left behind. But no, he's fine. I know Simon. Simon's a good man. All right, let's turn over to Romans 3. We left off with verse 26. We've seen that chapter 4 really should have begun, perhaps, with verse 24, because justification is now introduced as the gift of righteousness which comes from God, so that we might be viewed and treated by God in terms of what Christ has done, not in terms of what we've done. Here, then, he says in 26, in order for God to be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus, God had to provide that righteousness. Verse 27. Where then is boasting? Now, this is a natural question that would arise with Paul's understanding of salvation. If you and I, in terms of our goodness and our kindness and our good works, if we are not the ones providing for our own salvation, it's not autosoteric, we are not saving ourselves by our good works, well, then where is the opportunity for us human beings to boast and to say, well, I made it to heaven, I served Christ for years, and I did this and I did that? Because, you see, like the Pharisee who went to pray and stood next to the publican and said, Lord, I thank you that I'm not like that man, and I tithe, and I... You see, that's the heart of all non-Christian religions. Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam. I pray seven times a day facing a Mecca. The human heart wants to take credit for salvation, that if you're going to make it to heaven, you want to pat yourself on the back. And you want to say, I made it because I'm better than other people. So the Apostle Paul wisely understood that the doctrines of grace, particularly of justification, based upon the transference of the good works of Jesus to our account, because he's already established in verses 10 through 18, we don't have any, utterly excludes the opportunity for people to think they're holier than thou, better than other people. It levels everyone to the foot of the cross. So it doesn't matter if you're rich or poor or middle class. It doesn't matter if your IQ is 40 or 400, if it was such a possible thing. It doesn't matter. He said, what about boasting then? You mean I can't boast? He said, it is, look at that word, excluded. Excluded. The Greek is emphatic. It's out. In no sense whatsoever can anyone ever boast that they made it to heaven by anything they did. As we'll see perhaps later, even faith and repentance are the gifts of God. So you can't say, I made it to heaven because I believed and I accepted Jesus. No. He had already said in verses 10 through 18 that no one is seeking for God. And we aren't even seeking for God if left to ourselves. We don't want God. In a debate I had with an atheist yesterday, I said that atheism indeed is a form of what we call in psychology of wish fulfillment. They do not want God to exist. Later on, the guy admitted, basically, he did not want God. He did not even want to go to heaven. If he had to choose, he would go to hell rather than to go to heaven. He would choose the devil over God. And you can see it's the want-tos is our problem. Why don't we have more people at church today? Because they don't want to go. Why don't people show up here? Why don't they read their Bible every day? Because they don't want to. You said, yeah, but they say they want to. Well, that's fine. Anybody can say anything they want. But I know this much, if you want to go see Honey, I Blew Up the Kid, it's funny how you managed to get there to take your kids. And here he said, boasting is out. It is excluded. It is gone. Then the natural question that comes up to the Jewish mind, remember, you must be thinking as a Jew. See, the Jew, the Pharisee would say, oh, your view of salvation by grace through faith alone, that leaves no room for human merit. He said, yeah, you got it. You finally got it. Well, then, isn't salvation by the law? See, they always love the law. Well, by what kind of law, then, is salvation to come? What kind of law? Is it of works? And Paul cannot be clearer. I wish every Roman Catholic priest could just study these two verses. Look what he says. Of works, and look at the next word. Underline it, circle it. No. Couldn't be any clearer in any language. No, no, no. Salvation excludes boasting, because salvation does not come through the law. It comes through the gospel. It does not come through works. But if you want to know what law it is and how salvation comes, he said, listen, salvation comes to us by a law of faith. Now here the Apostle Paul had a smile when he wrote this. He just twisted the word law, nomos. To the Jew, the word law meant works. Works. And now he said, oh, there is a law. You got to have a law? I'll give you a law. The law of faith. Not the law of baptism. Not the law of church membership. Not the law of circumcision. Not the law of being good and kind and dropping a cake off at your neighbor's house. He said, you got to have a law? Okay, I'll say it. It's a law. And here he really meant principle. And the Apostle Paul uses this word law in many different senses in the New Testament, including here, the principle. Yeah, there is a principle involved. It's not a law to run around with and think you're going to get works. No, he has here, faith is the opposite of works. He said, yes, there is a law, there is a principle, but it's faith, faith, faith. And would you please notice the grammar? Is there a comma? And he goes on to say, and works? And baptism, and confirmation, and communion, and obedience to the Holy See. No, there's a period. There's a period, a very simple period. In the next debate I have with the Roman Catholic, I'm going to say, now let's look at this text very carefully. Boasting is excluded on the basis of Paul's view of justification. On the Roman Catholic view of justification, it is not excluded. In the canons of Dort, it says the works that you do after baptism and regeneration are what justify you. It's the work of Christ, says the Catholic Encyclopedia, and your works. So you can always pat yourself on the back. Oh, that will be glory for me, glory for me, glory for me. But it says, no, 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 no. It's excluded. It's not of works. It's not through obedience to the laws of the Old Testament. Instead, salvation comes to us through faith, period. Period, period, period. And let the Campbellites get upset who teach baptismal regeneration, the Lutherans who teach baptismal regeneration, the Greek Orthodox. Yes, I know that the majority of, quote, Christendom, end quote, which is basically pagan anyway, believes in the hocus-pocus-mocus of H2O. But it's not here in the text. It's not here in the text. He said, listen, in my view of justification, God is justified, verse 26. He can be just and justify people at the same time because they have faith in Jesus. Therefore, all boasting in human merit is excluded. The law is excluded. Works are excluded. It's simply faith. In verse 28. For we maintain that a man is justified, and that is a present passive infinitive. Notice very carefully in the New Testament, in terms of Greek grammar, the only ones who were ever spoken of as justifying themselves are the Pharisees, who went about trying to establish their own righteousness. When Paul talks about justification as something that happens in the Christian life, we are always passive, for justification is something done to us. It's not something we do ourselves. And that's why here, for example, in the grammar of the passage, it is a present passive infinitive. Man is justified. He does not justify himself, which would be by himself, would have been a middle case, but that is not here. A man is justified by what? Faith. Faith. Now, this time he doesn't put a period, because he thinks, now maybe my readers still don't get the point. They're so steeped in works religion, he now gives a phrase which blew everybody out of the water. By faith, now some people would no doubt still try to sneak works into faith. And they do it to this day. So when I'm debating a Campbellite, they said, oh, we believe you're saved by faith, but faith is obedience to the works God has given. And they take faith as an empty skin and stuff works in there, like a sausage. But notice what Paul does. He said, a man is justified by faith, and the kind of faith I'm talking about is totally separate or apart from the works of God's law. Totally. He says you cannot stuff works into the skin of faith. It's not going to work. They are two separate things, and if it's of faith, it cannot be of works, and if it's of works, it cannot be of faith. And he will later say in Romans 11, if it's of grace, it cannot be of works, and if it's of works, it cannot be of grace. There are certain things which, even though you try desperately to mix them together, in the end they will separate. Oil and water being an easy example. And he said the kind of faith that justifies is a faith that is set apart. It is separate from any works. Yes?
I know it's here in the text. Maybe it's a small point. Verse 27, it ends with no by a law of faith. And then verse 28, by faith apart from the law. The word law there, small and uppercase, or uppercase, at least in my Bible. Why is it?
The translators in the New American Standard recognize that the word nomos is used. I did a paper once in seminary, 14 different senses of the word nomos, which is translated law. Now they realize the English reader is going to have difficulty with this. So when it referred specifically to the Old Testament, to the Old Covenant, legislated by God through Moses, they would put it in capital. They would also put it in capital if it referred to that section of the Old Testament as opposed to the law, the writings, and the prophets. But primarily it was capitalized when it referred to the Mosaic law, which is really what Judaism was all about. When the word law was put with a lowercase l, it was to indicate to you it meant something else. Generally, the word principle, it could mean various things. Here, they're saying that in their estimation, verse 28, when he said, apart from the works of the law, or of law, there's no thee there, it was to indicate that in their mind he was specifically excluding the Mosaic or the Old Covenant, the Mosaic law. This itself may be open to interpretation. I'm one of those who feel that Paul's basic concept of nomos was that law simply meant the revealed will of God in whatever particular covenant or dispensation it happened to be. And when he was talking, you cannot restrict him simply to the Mosaic economy. It means salvation does not come to us on the basis of obedience to some law or the other, regardless of when it was revealed. The Campbellites like to restrict it, and the Roman Catholics both like to restrict the phrase strictly to the Old Covenant, because then they turn around and say, well, that's because the time has changed, and now in order to be saved, you have to keep the laws of the New Covenant. See how slick? Very, very slick. But as a matter of fact, that's the way it works. I see our time has gotten away with us today. We will end with verse 28, and next week we'll pick up with verse 29.
For more resources to earnestly contend for the faith, visit faithdefenders.com.